April 13th, 2020. Happy day after Easter, if that's your thing. Like always, like every Easter, I got dressed up in my Sunday best, sweats, on the couch, with my coffee. It's funny, the first time we watched a mass on TV about a month ago, not knowing the environment situation, seventh grader actually whispered, needed a Kleenex. I was like, hey, we're on the couch. You can just speak up. It'll be all right. He used to think not having a knee was a cool deal. First time back, man. Having to wear pants, it's going to be an adjustment. Like every Easter, again, Easter traditions, the three of us got in a car and just drove around for an hour. Needed to get out of the crib. Chill, chill, chill. Nothing crazy. Windows up. Never got out of the car. We did fuel up, though. Don't forget to wear gloves when you go to the gas station. Just checked the bank account. No stimulus check yet. How can Big Brother not have a site where you can get an update on your check status? I mean, Amazon can give me a heads up 2 minutes after my socks leave the St. Charles Depot. Snooks can text me. Is it okay if we replace your hot jalapeno request with mild jalapenos? Don't have it in inventory. Lyft, for goodness sake, can diagram the in-route car by the second. And Uncle Sam can't give me an update on where my checks are. Crazy. Nationally, sounds like some cities might be hitting their coronavirus peak this week. Folks who know this kind of thing are predicting St. Louis is still a couple weeks away. No more attending school for 2019-2020 scholastic year. I got a cousin graduating from high school, and I feel for her. Me, personally, high school, when it was over, I was fine. If they had canceled graduation, wouldn't have been that big of a deal. Now, canceling college graduation ceremony, that would have been a drag. She's graduating from Viz. She's going to go to MIT. Or repeat after me, she is much smarter than I am. Kind of hope Viz and all the other high schools get together. Maybe something over Christmas break where the classes of 2020 can all get together and celebrate. It's an accomplishment. You know, 4 years, hopefully. Maybe five. You got through high school, you should have a chance to cut some cake. Saw Back to the Future over the weekend, was channel surfing. There was a scene where the big punchline was how far in the future they were talking about. And what was that year? 2024. Kind of made me chuckle. Three things that you should check out if you have not already. Show called House of Lies. Ran for five seasons on Showtime. You got Don Chaney, Kristen Bell. They drive most of the show. Ben Schwartz and Jenny Slate. If you are Parks and Rec fans, they have recurring roles in that prior to Parks and Rec. It plays like a lot of scenes do with Sherlock Holmes, if you saw that episode or if you've seen that series on PBS, where one person walks around, everybody else is kind of stuck in time, a lot of fast dialogue, nothing groundbreaking, but once I started to watch it again, you know, stayed in my rotation. It's currently on Prime, and I didn't know that Chidi was born in Kansas City. Here's one off the beaten path, maybe a little spiritual with the whole Easter thing going on. It's a movie. It's called The Invention of Lying. It stars Ricky Gervais and Jennifer Gardner, among others. The premise is that no one lies. Nobody even knows it's possible to lie. When Gervais attempts to console his dying mom, tells her, hey, it's not scary, there's heaven, there's a big guy in the sky, everybody goes nuts. Again, you know, if you're not a Gervais fan, I get it, but it's a good, interesting take. I liked it, and a lot of good movies, sneaky good movies that never caught on. The cast is phenomenal. You got Rob Lowe, Tina Fey, Louis C.K., I'm going to keep going, Jonah Hill, Jason Bateman, Edward Norton, keep going, Philip Seymour Hoffman. There's a bit about the commandments that's pretty clever you want to catch. And the scene at the bar with C.K. and Hoffman, it's about 20 minutes in, it's worth the wait. Rounding out the trifecta of three things today, how about this? No live music, their tour was canceled. Go out and get yourself an early Stones album. Remember how good they were, why they mattered. Exile on Main Street is the proverbial favorite when quote-unquote experts rank their catalog. It's a double album. Here's what's weird. Go back to it. Just not a hit on the album. There's one, like Tumbling Dice or something like that. But it's a fantastic record. It's just good American blues rock and roll. If you want to cheat, you can go out and get their first version of what their greatest hits album became, which is the live album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. So on to today's guest. Not many people, if anybody, know more about St. Louis football than Howard Balzer. The thing that's odd about Howard is that I don't think folks locally understand how respected he is nationally. He's kind of been the odd man out in a couple all-sports incarnations. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, but he's always found a way to be relevant, stay above the water, stay important. Couple highlights from this episode that I enjoyed. He's got a couple great Joel Buschbaum stories. And if you don't know who Joel Buschbaum is, you should, and you'll find out. And then let's hear from Howard on what it was like to be on the set for the first time ESPN had a draft day broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, here's my enjoyable chat with Howard Balzer.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And away we go. It was funny. My wife and I were talking about the last time I'd probably had like a decent conversation with you lengthwise. It was at my housewarming party.
I kind of, you know, it's funny. It was just the other day. I was thinking of that because you had called and I happened to be going from somewhere to somewhere and I was coming down McKelvey
right
towards Dorset. And I remember, David's house was over here on the left somewhere on one of those streets.
And here we find ourselves now.
Yeah, funny.
So the wife at the time was Nadine. My wife remembers.
Aideen, yeah.
And are you still married?
Not to her. But I am married. Number three. This will be the last one.
kind of making a joke. How do you propose the third time? I mean, she obviously knows you've been married twice before. How do you do it?
It wasn't, you know, we were together, so there wasn't really a proposal.
Gotcha.
It was just going to be, you know, when we decided, hey, I mean, it's time. Let's just get married.
You grew up out east, correct?
Correct.
Where at?
Philadelphia, mostly Philadelphia.
And what did mom and dad do?
My mom was mostly a homemaker until she decided to go back to school for her graduate degree and ended up doing social work. And actually in Philadelphia, this goes way, way back to the 60s, started the special education and school district in Philadelphia for special needs kids.
Wow.
She pretty much formed it. It was pretty impressive. I didn't realize how impressive at the time it was. But yeah, it was pretty amazing. My father was sold women's clothes. He traveled around to different cities selling women's clothes to stores. So that's what he ended up doing.
Do you have any sisters who benefited from his job?
I have a sister who lives in New York. She did become a social worker right after, kind of in her mother's footsteps, and she's doing pretty well.
When I think of 60s New York, I think of stickball. Were you a stickball guy?
Not as much stickball, although there was a lot of wiffle ball, and what else? We had kickball and all those things. But I never lived in either New York or Philadelphia. It was never like in those city streets where that's where all the kids played.
Gotcha.
In the street. I pretty much always lived in homes and all that. So, but I do remember playing in my front yard and throwing a ball. One of the things I remember the most is I was starting to play Little League baseball. And it was interesting because I went to my high school reunion in Philadelphia in October. I'll age myself here. It was my 50th high school reunion. And so I went with my wife. She had never been back east. And so we drove around to the two homes that I lived in. And I showed her this first home we lived in, which I always will remember because it was kind of an older house. And the wall was just cement. And there was this open area between windows where at the bottom, this is about the bottom of it, maybe about a foot and a half off the ground, the wall would come down. And then there was a little kind of ridge that was tilted towards the ground, and then it came down. And I discovered if you took a ball, and I would use one of the, remember those old pinky balls?
Sure.
And if you threw a ball at that spot, you never knew how it was going to come off it. Sometimes it would hit right on the tilted part, and it would be like a fly ball or a pop-up. Other times it would hit below it, and it would be a grounder. Other times if I hit right on the where it went down, it would come back real fast, almost as a line drive. And I would be out there for hours doing that. And it turned out I ended up being a pretty good fielder in Little League and some of the other, when I played softball later in my life just for fun. I ended up being a pretty good fielder, and I attribute it to all those hours throwing that ball against the wall.
So you played in high school?
Didn't play high school and didn't make my high school team, but played Little League, played a little bit of American Legion, but I actually played golf in high school.
You still a stick?
Once in a while. Don't play a lot. And usually I'll play only in celebrity celebrity events that are scrambles. But with all the things I always got going on, as busy I am, I just haven't devoted the time to keep up. I'll play maybe once or twice a year, but I enjoy it.
I got to the point playing golf, and I have, you know, I don't play much anymore, but when we played in scrambles, I'll just see you at the 150 stick. There's really no reason for me to take out a club until we get the 150.
Well, yeah, now that's definitely the case with me now. I used to be able to hit it. I can still hit it decent, but certainly don't have the power that I once did. But I ended up playing freshman when they actually had freshman teams in college, I actually played freshman basketball at my college, Hofstra University. When I think back on it, I say, how in the world did I make that team? But the funny story about it was, and I always played basketball, just played around intramurals and all that, and I could shoot it pretty decent. And so I'd gotten friendly with a guy in college, and we were just talking one day, and he said, hey, you should try out. He told me he was trying out for the basketball team, the freshman team. And so he said, I should try out, because we had played around a little bit. I said, what, are you crazy? I'm not going to be good enough. I couldn't make my high school team. So he said, well, here's the thing, though. There's only 3 players on scholarship that they had. So that means they need 7 other people to fill out a team. And who are they going to be? Where are they going to come from? Most people wouldn't even try out thinking that. So I said, okay, why not? So I tried out, and I made it. And I didn't play much. But it was kind of a fun year, traveling around, going to different cities and all those things, and got to know a lot of different people. And by doing that, it got me more, because I was writing for the school paper.
The Chronicle.
At the time, the Hofstra Chronicle, exactly. So I was writing for the paper, but then I met other people who were doing sports information and things like that, which I didn't know existed, and I started getting into that. So being on that basketball team was really, really crucial in terms of the things that I ended up doing after college and leading to my career.
Anybody good on that basketball team we know about?
Not on my freshman team. There was a couple guys that were pretty good. I remember one of them's name was Matt LaPuma, and another one's name was Alan Wolfson. And they were pretty good when they went on to varsity, but no one of a big name.
Hofstra's got some very famous alum. Did you go to school with Jimmy Kahn or hang out with, I think, Bernie Madoff?
Didn't go to school with anyone. There was one guy, and this will be a guy that's hard to describe, but if you saw his picture, you would know you'd know who he was, because he was one of those character actors that always played like rough guys and tough guys and mafia guys and things like that, and his name was Mike Starr. And I always remembered him. Tried to track him down once, and I wasn't able to do it, but he was there with me, and I got to know him pretty well. And then when he went on, all of a sudden he starts showing up in these different movies and all that. So anyone out there, just Google Mike Starr, and you'll probably see his picture, and that's the guy.
You ever work at WRHU?
Yes. Yeah, did some radio work there. Not a lot, but I did some, and in fact, did some. I actually got into lacrosse a little bit in college, not to play, but Hofstra had a pretty good lacrosse program, and I ended up being the PA guy sometimes at some games in the spring, and then as I got into the sports information office, I was involved in that. But then piggybacking off that, I did some radio in college, and that kind of gave me the radio bug. The interesting thing about it, David, is that when I went to school, and certainly you grow up and you're listening. It was kind of the birth of talk radio, but you listen to talk radio, get the newspaper and read the stories that were in the paper and all that. It never dawned on me at that time that those were actual jobs and careers, that the people doing that was their career. It never dawned on me until I got to college. In fact, I went to college to be a business major. And then when I saw all this, I said, no, this is what I want to do when I'm done with school, is to get into what I really wanted to do was get into like work in a school sports information or a team's public relations department, something like that. But like I said, I never realized sports information directors existed until I got to school, or that, like I said, that those other guys on radio and all that those were actual careers and jobs. And so when I realized that, I said, yeah, that's what I want to do.
And this radio station was not just a student station. This was a very popular. It's actually, they still have the Islander games on that station?
I think they very well might now. Now then, it was. Remember, we're talking the late '60s into the early 70s. So then it was pretty much students, and it was much smaller, but it's grown over the years. In fact, when I decided to said, this is what I want to do, I was like, okay, what courses am I going to take? Let's take journalism. At Hofstra, they didn't even have a journalism department then. They didn't even have journal. They just had a couple of journalism courses within the English department. This was back then. Now, it's a tremendous journalism department with expanded TV and radio and all those things. But back in the old days, they didn't have a whole lot of that. It's really grown tremendously.
Because Syracuse is a big journalism school.
Very
too.
Big. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what is the National Wheelchair Athletic Association?
I was doing PR for that group, and they just publicized and created the rules and all that for different wheelchair athletic events throughout the country. And I was in New York where I was working for them, and they coordinated it all, and I helped them with PR and sending out releases and editing certain things that they put together. And the interesting thing about it was that one of my roommates in college was a wheelchair-bound person, and he played wheelchair basketball. In fact, I played in some kind of promotional charity games where the wheelchair basketball team would play the Hofstra varsity in a game, but all the varsity were in wheelchairs. And I had played a little bit, and they added me to the team, and I actually was pretty good. My friend used to say to me, joking, he said, man, we got to get you handicapped and disabled in some way, and you can play with us. And so, but I also never forget this. The wisdom of the NCAA, they wanted to play this charity game against the varsity, and they had to clear it with the NCAA. And the NCAA first said that they couldn't do it because Hofstra had already exhausted its number of allowable games for that particular season. Well, it got a little publicity. Some people with some big-time radio stations in New York went public with it, and it embarrassed the NCAA so much that they had to give in. But I always remember that incident, that the NCAA in its infinite wisdom was not going to let college basketball players sit in a wheelchair to play a game for charity purposes against a wheelchair team. That was pretty bizarre. I could never understand that.
But a good experience.
Oh, great! Oh, yeah, it was a great experience. So, you know, all that. And then, you know, I worked for them for a couple of years, and did a lot of good things, and got to know a lot of what they did. Because I mean, I think they still have it till this day. I mean, they have the Paralympics, which often are in the same year, maybe as the Olympics or the I don't know. Do they still have the games in South America that they used to have, the Pan American Games? I don't know if they still have them, but the United States had a wheelchair team in a lot of different events. It wasn't just only basketball. They would have track and field events and a lot of things like that. It was pretty extensive, and I don't know how much of it still is, but it was pretty extensive back in those days.
When's the next time you're getting back?
Back
east? Do
you have
a trip? Yeah, back east.
Well, October was the last one. I'll actually be going in October. My sister's son is getting married, so looking forward to that. We were just there. It's ironic. He's getting married the same weekend, the way it falls, as his sister got married 2 or 3 years ago when we went back. So looking forward to going back in the fall.
Now, if memory serves, you have a good singing voice.
Well, I don't judge it, but others have said that I sing okay.
Did you ever get to do up on the street corner?
Never did do up on the street corner. The only thing I've ever really done is karaoke, although I do participate in St. Louis in a group called Broadway Fantasies, which it's an older person's group. Most everybody is at least 50 years old in it, and I've been doing that for about 15 years and put on a show every June that raises money for an outfit called CORE, C-O-R-P-S, County Older Residents Programs for senior citizens and all that, raises money for that. And I do that every year with a lot of people I've gotten to know very well. So it's fun singing in that and some karaoke, but never did do up on the corner.
What's the encore?
The encore? Well,
that your group does. Do you have a show stopping, everybody gets up, last song of the evening?
The last song of the evening is one. We have a guy who is pretty well known around town, in fact. His name is Joe Dreyer. And he's a great piano player, writes a little bit of his music. His wife, Rosemary, does acting and singing and all that, and they do some shows together. And so he wrote a song about 5 years ago, I want to say, called Same Time Next Year. And so after the finale number, as everyone's going through their bows, we sing Same Time Next Year to say, hey, hope you enjoyed this, and we'll see you again next time right here, same time next year.
How old is Joe?
Joe, I would say, is, I'm going to say he's in his 50s. Maybe early 60s. I'm not 100%
sure. I went to school
sure.
with a Joe, but oh, really? He'd be like in his 50s. Joe Dwyer. But I'm sure he's not the same guy.
This is Joe Dreyer.
Dreyer.
With an R. The funniest thing about Joe is that there was this, you might have seen it, there was an HBO documentary on Robin Williams. And it was a really tremendous documentary. So anyway, it was about 6 or 7 months ago, and I had taped it and hadn't watched it. And one night I was looking through my long list of stuff. I said, I got to watch this. So I'm watching the documentary, and they have him doing like improv and stuff and like this in kind of a little comedy group in San Francisco in California, because he had been out there for a certain part of his career. And all of a sudden the camera goes on the audience, and I see this guy. And remember, we're talking about 40, 50 years ago. And I see this guy, and I said, man, that looks like Joe. I said, that couldn't be. He's just sitting there in the audience. So I emailed him. It was. He was there that night, and the camera just happened to catch him in this little thing. And he said, I've gotten a lot of texts from people wondering if that was me. And yes, it was.
So you get to St. Louis around 78.
78, exactly.
Sporting News?
Came to work for the Sporting News, exactly.
What'd you do for them?
At the time when I came here, it was to edit their books. And the funny part of this, well, maybe not funny, but the interesting part of the story is I was working in Long Island, and I had applied for this job that was advertised in the Sporting News, of all places, for a book editor. Because they at the time, they had all these statistical books on all the major sports, and they needed someone to edit them. And I thought it was odd at the time that they would advertise in the newspaper. Because you can imagine, a newspaper with hundreds of thousands of subscribers, many of them stat geeks who think that they know all there is to know about numbers, can imagine the people that would apply for this job. So anyway, I applied for it and didn't hear anything right away. And I had been doing some freelance work in New York for an outfit at the time. This was before computers, called Amfax Communications. And writers who would go to games, this was after the days of Western Union, how they would transmit their stories, they would send their stories on the forerunner of the fax machine. They were called telecopiers. And there was a long cylinder, and it would go around in a circle. Well, no writer was going to carry that around. So this company would provide, I'd go to the games, and we'd have different newspapers that we would have contracts with, and we would, and I'd be able to watch the games, and then I had to stay there afterwards. I was just sitting there waiting for the guy to write a story, and then just transmit it, and that's what I did for a few bucks. And so I had met someone there who worked for the Elias Sports Bureau. I had met someone at the games I was going to. The funny part of it is, a guy who passed away several months ago, you might have heard the name Seymour Siwoff. Mm-mm. He started the Elias Sports Bureau in the 50s, and they became the statistical bedrock of Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA. They kept all the stats. And so when you see, a lot of times these days, if you see statistics on a game that this player is the leader after six games of his career, they get that from the Elias. And a lot of times they'll put Elias down, they'll credit them with a statistic. Well, I was out at work at the time in New York, and there was a story about Seymour in, of all places, Playboy magazine. And yes, I was reading the magazine for the articles. And I read this article about him, and I never heard of Elias Sports Bureau at that time. So I wrote him a letter. And
you wrote a what?
I wrote a letter. I wrote a letter.
A letter.
Typed it on a typewriter, pulled the paper out, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, addressed the envelope, and mailed it to Seymour. And crazy thing is, he got back to me. Said, I don't have anything right now, but he gave me a couple suggestions of places I could call. Well, as it turned out, none of those worked out. But when I got to the Sporting News years later, Seymour got in touch with me, and he says, I always had a feeling about you. And that was the way he talked. But the crazy part is, I met this guy at a game, and I'd see him and all this, and we'd say hello. And one day, he heard someone calling me by my name. And he came up to me, And he said, did you say your name's Howard Balzer? And I said, yes. And he goes, that name sounds familiar. Did you write a letter to Seymour at Elias? I said, yeah, I did. He worked for Elias. And that's how I met him. Well, fast forward now, I see him at a game, and I said, hey, name is Bob Rosen. I said, Bob, do you ever have contact with the Sporting News? He said, well, yeah, every day. Every day we talk to him to reconcile the box scores that the Sporting News prints on baseball. I speak to a guy named Larry Wiggy, who, God rest his soul, passed away a little less than a year ago. And I talk to him every day. So I said, well, I applied for this job at the Sporting News. I haven't heard back. He says, well, let me see what I can do. 2 days later, I get a call from a guy from the Sporting News who had fished my resume out of the box for whatever reason. I don't know why he didn't take a liking to it, and called me and offered me the job.
All based on $60 billion a year.
What's that?
$60 billion a year.
Well, the funny thing about it was, what they offered me in salary, I said, really? That's all it is? And you're owned by Times Mirror? This is all you're offering? And I actually turned it down. Actually turned the job down.
Played hardball.
Well, it wasn't even playing hardball. It was just, I had a son on the way, and my first son, and I would be taking a pay cut, which I knew I would be able to live less expensively in St. Louis than New York. But the funny part of it was, that night after turning it down, I thought, ooh, I have the connection with Amfax. I could probably do that. Maybe I could do that in St. Louis to make a couple extra bucks and go to the games. So the guy said, yeah, we need a guy in St. Louis. Called back the next day. They had already given the book editor job to someone else. I said, okay, just the way it goes sometimes. Well, a month later, approximately, someone retired who was the partner, if you will, with Larry Wiggy. Larry Wiggy handled National League box scores for the Sporting News. This other guy, name was Chris, I forget his last name, handled American League. And so when Chris retired, and so the guy they had hired for the book editor job, they asked him, hey, do you want to still stay with the book editing, or do you want to do American League box scores? So he chose the box scores. They called me back to offer me the job again. And this time, so I'm thinking in the back of my mind, they told me that someone retired. So I said, well, this guy retired. He's been there a while. That freed up some money here. So I said, well, is the salary more than you had offered originally? And he told me the number, and it was $500 a week more. That was it. $500 a year more.
Okay.
So that's $10 a week.
You get cheese on that burger.
Yeah, basically. $10 a week more. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that's like nothing. But I said, I thought to myself, how many times does someone get offered a job at the Sporting News twice? And so I took it. Had never been west of the East, except for a little bit of visiting some people, and never lived anywhere. And I said, well, man, I'm going to an unknown place, St. Louis. And that's how I ended up here.
Do you remember your first impressions of St. Louis?
Yes. My first impressions were twofold, because I left New York alone. My wife had just given birth to our son about 6 weeks earlier, didn't have a place to live. They wanted me to start on this certain date. And so I drove out myself, and my wife stayed back, and I'll say, I'll look for a place, you know, condo, you know, townhouse, whatever, and then you'll all come out. And so I left. I was starting on a Monday. I left New York on a Friday. It had snowed the night before, and the roads weren't too bad. And they were a little dicey for a while until I got west of Pennsylvania, where it kind of opened up. And when I got to St. Louis, it was a gorgeous day. This was January, middle of January. It's kind of like the way we all know it is in St. Louis. It could be 60 one day in January or February, and the next day it's 20. It was a gorgeous day, sunny and all that. And so the second impression is the guy at the Sporting News named Joe Marson said, hey, and I gave a call to my buddy. It's right up the street from the Sporting News, and you can stay there until you find a place.
Because the Sporting News at the time is on Lindbergh.
On Lindbergh,
right
on Lindbergh, right near Olive. Mm-hmm. The Ivy Motel, which is still there.
First class, I'm sure.
Yeah, a no-tell motel. That's where I was staying. Didn't even have a telephone in the room. You had to go, didn't even have a telephone in the main office. If I wanted to call home, I had to go, no cell phones then. I had to go to this payphone booth outside the front office of the place. And
which I'm sure was an extremely safe place to go.
It wasn't unsafe, but at times it was cold standing in there. And if I had felt a little more confident, I would have went in and said to the boss, I said, hey, you got to get me into a regular hotel until I find a place. This is ridiculous. But I'm at the Sporting News. I just didn't say a word. And so, but the second part of this, when I said it was twofold, oh, and it didn't even have carpeting on the floor. It was like linoleum, and there was a potbelly stove in there. I mean, it was crazy. But Sunday morning, I woke up to go to my first day on the job, and overnight, it had snowed 5 inches. And I said, okay, well, this is how I can change in St. Louis. And thankfully, I was right down the road. It took like 1 minute to get there. But at that moment is when I decided wherever I live in St. Louis, it's going to be close to the office.
How and when do you start following the football Cardinals?
It was interesting the way that all developed, because I was doing the books, and then the following year, I got there in January, and I did the books, and it was, I'm trying to remember if it was that, it might have been the following year that I was, we would get newspapers from all over the country, and they'd pass the sports sections around, because when I got there, I was doing a book called The Baseball Register, which had all the stats, but all the transactions for players, when they were released, when they were cut, if they were traded, if they went down to the minors, when they came back, put on the disabled list, whatever it was. And there was actually someone at the Sporting News, a gal named Melissa, I believe her name was, and her basic job on these little 3x5 cards, index cards, was to take the notice that Major League Baseball sent out every week with all the transactions on it and type them onto these 3x5 cards, so that when someone did the Baseball Register, they went and got a guy's card and then retyped the information onto a sheet where someone in the back room would type it into the system for the Baseball Register. So I did that book. My next book was the Football Register. So I asked the guy who had done it the year before, where's all the information on the football guys? He says, there isn't any. So what do you mean there isn't any? How do you know when they were cut or released? He says, you have to keep track of it yourself through Associated Press or whatever.
And this is 78.
This was 78, and it might have been 79 as we worked towards it, because the Football Register was done maybe around spring or whatever, maybe early summer. And so I started my own system for football transactions. I created my own 3x5 cards. And much of the information I got from going through those newspapers.
See, what's funny is, so I'm growing up, 78, I'm 10-ish. I'm doing book reports on your statistical books.
There we go. How about that?
I literally would do that. Also, when you talk about stats, it's really hard for someone my age in St. Louis to not think about Joel Buschbaum.
Oh, gosh.
So give me a Buschbaum story.
Let me just finish this one, because you asked how I got into the football aspect of it. So I start reading all the newspapers to find the transactions. Because if you looked in the Post-Dispatch or the Globe at the time, they'd have the AP transactions, but they never had them all. There would be teams that didn't announce them. The writer might have it in the local paper, but it wouldn't make the wire. So I started reading the papers to keep track of the transactions. Then I'd also see some stories that were written about the teams and notes and things like that that hardly anybody knew about. So I suggested to the managing editor, and I think this was 79, I said, you know, we should be covering football more here. We should be covering football more, and especially in the off season when a lot of people aren't getting information. We should at least have a page or a column with football notes. And he said to me, well, that's a pretty good idea. He was very receptive to it. And then he said, who could do that? Because most of the time the Sporting News hired other people, writers from other papers, to do this stuff. So I said, well, I could. So he said, okay, give it a shot. And I started writing a weekly NFL notes column, which got noticed, obviously. It was a national paper. That's what led to me being on the first NFL draft in 1980. And so 40 years this in April will be the 40th anniversary. And so that's how I got involved in the football end of it and all those things. So that really jump-started what ended up me being really certainly concentrating on football. But Joel, man, I love – someone asked me on the radio a couple weeks ago about him and the memories of him.
Did you know him?
I met him. Yes, that was the interesting story, because when I was one of my the first radio jobs I had in St. Louis was first on 550, which was KSD then.
I remember.
And they hired a guy named Bud Brewer to do a daily show. And I would come on as a guest every now and then talking about the NFL and the draft. And then they got Billiken's basketball. I think that was in 79. And I ended up being the fill-in host because he was doing the Billiken's games. And then one day, the publisher of our paper, C.C. Johnson Spink, said to Robert Hyland at KMOX, you know, you have all these people on it, you know, you should have someone from our play, you know, and he suggested me to go on KMOX. And so in 1980, I started at KMOX. And so I would be on there doing weekly shows, mostly on the weekends. And when the football season would come around, I would be there on a Sunday night, a lot of times with Bob Costas, a lot of times with Bill Wilkerson, and Joel would be a guest with his, of course, inimitable voice. He's got great upper body strength, super acceleration off the ball, but between the ears, he's empty. Or it would be, I mean, and then he'd go into his explanation. So it was just a blast.
That show, there'd always be somebody whose cousin with four string
guy at Pittsburgh State,
Alabama State,
and he would know him.
It
was amazing. It was amazing. One great Joel story was he had been on the air for maybe 2 or 3 years one Sunday, and Bill's introduces Joel, and all of a sudden Joel does one of his famous, "Hold it, Bill, hold it," and Bill says, "What? What's up, Joel?" And he says, "It's Buxbaum, not Bushbaum."
Hmm.
Because if you really look the way the name is spelled, it's B-U-C-H-S.
Pronounced it incorrectly.
Yeah, but you look at it, and especially in St. Louis, you think Bushbaum. So he goes, "It's Buxbaum, not Bushbaum." And I'll never forget this, David. Bill Wilkerson, without missing a beat, says, "Joel, it's been Bushbaum for this long, so Bushbaum, it's going to stay." So in terms of meeting him, no one had ever seen him. He did radio in Houston. He did radio here in St. Louis. He did radio in other markets. But he was basically in his Brooklyn apartment virtually all the time, except when he went out to walk his dog. Never married. I don't know if he ever had a girlfriend. His mom lived in the apartment, I believe, right next door to him, next to him in this Brooklyn apartment building. And no one had seen him. So there were all kinds of rumors about him, that he was handicapped, that it was a computer-generated voice, that this guy really didn't exist, or any of this. So it was either the 1981 or the 1982 draft that I'm on ESPN, and I'm in New York sitting at a little table getting ready for the draft maybe about a half hour before. Dr. Z, Paul Zimmerman from Sports Illustrated, is next to me, to my right, and all of a sudden I hear to my right the voice. And it says, "Hey, Paul, Jeff Bryant is moving up on everybody's list." He was giving him a little tip about the draft. And Jeff Bryant was a defensive end from Clemson who was a relatively highly rated player, but he was saying he was going to be a top player pick. Turned out he was either fourth or sixth overall. So whatever his information was right on. But all of a sudden, I hear that voice and I look up, and there's Joel with... Look, I described him as a young Woody Allen, or younger Woody Allen. Straggly hair, looked like it hadn't been washed and he hadn't slept in weeks, which he probably hadn't, getting ready for the draft, wearing a Notre Dame sweatshirt, and there at the draft in New York at the hotel. And so I looked at Joel and I said, "Hey, Joel, Howard Balzer, good to meet you." And he goes, "I know who you are." Just like that. The next part of the story that was funny is ESPN, near the end of the broadcast, long day, and they only did, I think, the first round then. Maybe they did the second, but the first round would take forever a lot of times, 6-7 hours. So near the end of the day, it's near the end of the round. Not as many people are interested late in the round as they are in the first. They put Joel on TV. Talk about a disaster. Not only how he looked, but he was nervous, and he wasn't, you know, speaking like normal, and plus he had the accent. I'll never forget, I heard in my ear from the producer's truck someone go, "Never again." But he became an icon.
I listened to him
in the business
all the time.
Yeah,
so
all his draft info, and he was close to Bill Belichick. In fact, when he passed away suddenly at the age, I forget how old he was, but he was relatively young, and it was in late December. And at the Combine, they had a memorial service for him at the NFL Scouting Combine in February. And Bill Belichick spoke at it. He used to talk with Joel all the time. And Joel talked to some other teams too, but that was one of his best sources.
The first televised draft is 1980.
Correct.
So that people remember ESPN at this time is most known for yacht races.
Yes.
And I think if you wanted to point at a place where football became more than just a six-month sport, it'd be with the creation of televising this draft.
Yeah, it definitely was. And
you were there. You were on television. You were at the table.
Yeah.
How did you get that call?
Yeah, that was interesting the way that happened. Let's remember also, you mentioned what they were famous for at the time. I don't know if they were even famous for anything. They were just, because they had just gone on the air the previous September. And so they didn't have contracts with colleges. And so they didn't have college football games. So they go into this draft without highlights or virtually anything. It was just talking heads in two different places, in Bristol and New York. Well, about 2 or 3 weeks before the draft, I get a call from a producer from ESPN who wants to know if they can use the Sporting News mock draft, the prediction of the first round, use the Sporting News mock draft in their broadcast and just refer to it in the predictions. So I said, well, sure, I'm sure there'd be no problem with that. But then I said, but here's the problem with that, is that first, the draft was on a Tuesday then. Sporting News goes to press on a Monday. Well, it wasn't the day before the draft. It was that we would have a mock draft in, because by the time the people got the newspaper, the draft would be over. So the mock draft was put in the week before. So it was done 10 days in advance. So I says, that's one problem. If there's good rumors or a trade or something happens, it wouldn't be reflected in it. But the most important aspect, I said to the guy, was, well, if we have the guy pick third overall and maybe he goes second, or someone picks someone else at third, now he's not taken, and all of a sudden the whole draft is thrown off. So what do you do if you get to 4, 5, and 6 and this guy's already taken or any of those things? And I suggested to him, I said, hey, I do radio in St. Louis. You could potentially have me on the phone and just do a little radio hookup, and, you know, every now and then, wouldn't be all the time, every now and then, okay, you know, we're coming up with the fourth pick, and the Sporting News had, and then talk about it, maybe what that team might do, talk about needs, what's coming up in the next couple picks. I just threw that out as a wild suggestion. And I don't remember if it was that day or the next day, whenever it was, the producer calls me back and he says, how'd you like to come to Bristol and be on the show? I was shocked. I said, well, sure, that'd be great. And that's how I began doing the draft for ESPN. I was in Bristol in the studio with Bob Lee.
Of course, yeah, because the Sheridan had the George Grand.
At George Grand. And a lot of people think Paul Zimmerman was on that one. He was not. He didn't go on there until about a year later. And Mel Kiper didn't come on until a couple of years later. And they had Sal Marciano, who was also a broadcaster, did some of the sports centers and all that with George at ESPN. And they had Joe Thomas, who was a longtime NFL general manager.
Colts, right?
Colts, yeah, and the Saints.
Berman there?
No, Chris Berman was. I think he might have done some behind the scenes stuff, but I'm not sure he was there yet at the network in 1980. At that time, in April of 1980, and I was with Bob Lee in Bristol, along with Vince Papale, the former Philadelphia Eagles player, who was the subject of the movie Invincible.
The Mark Wahlberg movie.
The Mark Wahlberg movie.
I saw that.
When Dick Vermeil was the head coach and had tryouts for just because they had no draft picks when Dick took over the Eagles. In fact, everyone talks, they didn't have drips. When I say no draft picks, first, second, or third round, his first year in 1976, they didn't have draft picks. 77, they didn't have a first or a second round pick. So he was just trying to put a roster together. So we had these mass tryouts. And Papale was like a bartender in Philadelphia and tried out and made the team. So by then he wasn't playing. I think his career was over by then. He made it and played a couple of years. So he was on the broadcast along with Upton Bell, who was the son of Burt Bell, one of the first NFL commissioners back in the 30s. He was an owner of the Philadelphia Eagles and then became commissioner of the NFL in like the 30s and the 40s. So that was essentially the crew. And they had one person, as I recall, was a gal named Leandra Riley, who would go up into the balcony at the hotel where the Jets and Giants fans were and would interview them. That was the extent of the broadcast. They didn't have, you know, remote hookups and teams and war rooms or any of that. It was just sitting around, and people were wondering, man, is this going to be like paint drying? But it got pretty good reviews, and people watched.
Initially,
yeah, yeah, it got good reviews.
So when the draft was over, they were committed, and everybody was talking about what they were going to do the next year.
Yeah, pretty much. Nice. Yeah, pretty much. But I'll never forget the great story that Chet Simmons, who was the president of ESPN, told, because he had been at NBC and took the job at ESPN when it started out. And he was the one that suggested to Pete Rozelle, then the commissioner of the NFL, we're interested in televising the draft. And Pete Rozelle said, why in the world would you want to do that? That was his reaction. And now we see today what this thing is like on television. So that was a great experience. And then the other great part, interesting side story, is that the birth of Mel's Big Board in New York was partially thanks to me. Because when he started out on the show, I went to New York for the first time. I was in Bristol 80 and 81, and then was in New York in 82. Well, that narrows it down. So 82 is the year I was talking about with meeting Joel. So 82, I was in New York, and then 83 also. That was the big quarterback draft with obviously Marino and Elway and all those guys. Well, when I went to New York, they brought Mel Kiper in to be the analyst in Bristol. And so this one year, I think it was 84, I was in New York. And this you can actually see this picture on Google, where I'm standing with Chris Berman in front of this board that has names on it, this huge board for a graphic that they had. And you can see some names behind it. And that was the ESPN draft board that no one knew who put it together. And they would go to us every now and then, and he'd ask me, well, hey, you know, we have this guy number three on our draft board, and it wasn't a mock draft. It was a ranking, 1, 2, 3, and on down. Here's a guy we had ranked number three, and we're at the 8th pick. He hasn't been picked yet. What's going on? So you start giving opinions and all that. Well, after the draft every year, the producer would send a note to all of us, give some suggestions, some ideas for next year. So I said, well, you've got Mel Kiper in Bristol. He puts his own board together and ranks the players. Why not, if you're going to have a board, put it in someone's name, give it accountability, have it be Mel's big board. And the next year, he was in New York with the big board, and I wasn't in New York. They sent me to San Francisco.
And Mel gives you 10% of all of it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I don't even know if he acknowledges me.
No, you're a happy guy in general, but was there ever a time where you were like, that could have been me or that?
No, because I didn't study the draft anywhere close to the extent. And I have people come up to me this day, David, will say, oh, you were right there with Joel Buschbaum, really Buxbaum. I say, no, I really wasn't.
Well, the job,
I
mean, you should have had.
Not in terms of the depth of the draft and how deep those guys would go with knowing 300-400 players. I wasn't even close to those guys in terms of that. I readily admit that.
The job you should have had was George Boone's.
George Boone, yeah. Because the funny thing about that, you're right, because George Boone actually used to do pretty good on the later round picks, you know, getting Stump Mitchell in the 9th round or getting Lonnie Young in the 12th round. But the first round picks, those were an issue with
George.
As
a fan, it sure just seemed like he worked 1 week a year and it was at the Senior Bowl.
And you wonder how much he worked, because I'll never forget this story. The year that they drafted Anthony Bell in the first round, linebacker. I'm trying to remember if it was Michigan or Michigan State. I think it was Michigan, but I might be wrong. But they drafted him 6th overall, and he wasn't even first or second team Big Ten.
No Johnny Bearfield.
No, he was no Johnny. He was no Dr. Doom. But the real story was that after the draft, the Cardinals, and all teams would do this, they'd bring the players drafted to town, and they'd have a media get-together. They serve lunch, and the media could go around and interview these guys. And so at this get-together that year, and there's George Boone, goes up to Anthony Bell and introduces himself.
There were a lot of times.
And so I'm saying, hold it. That means he hadn't interviewed him. He hadn't met him. He a guy that you're going to draft sixth overall, had no sense of his personality or what he was all about. You hadn't even made sure to meet him before the draft. I was dumbfounded by that. And the crazy part of it was that I remember reporting it on the radio, whatever station I happened to be on at that time, and no one else, a lot of other people saw it, but no one reported on it. No one reported on it. And then I do recall, either after that season or maybe the next year, Bernie Miklas did a 3-part series in the Post-Dispatch called The Feudal Franchise and went over all the things that were wrong with it. And within that, he talked about George Boone not meeting and meeting players before the draft, and he defended himself. He said, well, they can snow you. They can put on an act and make them seem to be something they're not. And as soon as I read that, I said, that's even worse. Well, because isn't the job of an interviewer to get a gut feeling about someone and know if they're snowing you? Well, he was admitting that he couldn't tell the difference.
Well, and the one that I remember, and he was a Mizzou guy, but they draft the quarterback, yep, Steve Pazarkiewicz, who is legally blind in one eye.
Yes.
And because they don't do their due diligence in any way, shape, or form, that's a totally wasted pick. Duncan, I think, was...
I was going to bring up Clyde.
Didn't even know, had no idea he was going in the first round, maybe not even the first three.
And he was, I think he was 7th or 8th, somewhere in the top 10. And remember, you know, you have to have a bad record to be drafting in the top 10 year after year. And the classic Jim Hanifin story is, well, they drafted Clyde Duncan because he was fast. He went to Tennessee and he was fast.
And he had a good Senior Bowl.
Yeah, because he was fast. And so at the mini camp, Hanifin's laying eyes on him pretty much for the first time. And he goes up to Boone after one of the mini camp practices, and he says, you know how Jim is. I don't know if he had a cigarette in his mouth or not. He says, hey, George, he says, you know, got a little problem with this first round pick of yours. And so George says, yeah, what is it? And he says, he can't catch. You know, minor consideration for a guy that you draft high in the first round.
You talked about people seeing that interaction with Anthony Bell and Boone and not reporting it. What's the best story you had that you didn't leak?
That I didn't leak?
Yeah, you were sitting on it, but because of your relationships with people
that never got out?
Maybe got out eventually.
Well, I'll tell you,
I'll tell you
two good stories. One that I had to sit on for almost a week, but was able to write it and get the exclusive because no one in St. Louis wrote it. And the other was one that I absolutely had to sit on. Which one do you want first? And never reported until the Rams left.
Let's go first, second.
Which?
First one first, second one
first
second.
First one second. Okay, so it's the year that the Cardinals, the vote is coming down to have them move to Arizona. And we already know how the city basically scuttled Gene McNary's County Stadium and Earth City plan. Because when that looked like it was going to become real, the city could not have the team being outside the city limits. So then they started working on their stadium plan, which was haphazard, wasn't very good. They come to the NFL meeting in Phoenix, ironic enough, to present their stadium case to the league of why the Cardinals shouldn't be able to move. Now, let's remember one key thing here. The Cardinals did not have a stadium deal in Phoenix and didn't get a stadium for what? I think it was like 18 years after moving. I think it might be the only time a team has ever been allowed to relocate in professional sports to a new city where there wasn't a stadium plan promised and under contract. So anyway, the two guys that are presenting the plan are the Civic Progress guys, who I always kind of nicknamed Civic Regress. Chuck Knight from then, it's now Ameren, Missouri. What was it? Union Electric then, I guess. And William Cornelius from Emerson Electric. They were the two guys representing St. Louis to present this stadium plan to the owners. Well, of course, they picked Phoenix. So there was one point after where in the hotel where this is, where the media gets called down to a press conference. There's a hall, there's a little vestibule area where everyone hangs out. Then when there's a press conference, they walk down this hall, come into this little open area, and then go into a press conference room. We go in there, and they said, oh, there's been a delay. It's going to happen a little bit later. So, what's going on now? What's going on now? Well, most everybody walks out to go back down to the standing around area. Well, for whatever reason, I was the last one out, and I hung around a little bit, and there was one other person there from the Post-Dispatch, who wasn't Jim Thomas, it was Ed Cohn, who was the business writer, and he was there covering this from the business angle. Well, we happened to be standing there when out from this door, there was a back exit from the press conference room to a door that went into a makeshift temporary NFL office for the week of the league meeting. They come out of this door, and Chuck Knight is MFing Bill Cornelius. Don't you ever effing do that again, you MFer. Don't you ever embarrass me like that again. Don't you ever do that again. And they start arguing back and forth. I'm going, oh my God, what's going on here? Well, a little bit later, of course, they vote to allow the Cardinals to move. So I said, I got to find out what happened. And I've got, you know, some good contacts in the NFL. Well, I talked to a couple people, and they told me it was the most embarrassing presentation I'd ever seen in front of the NFL owners. Because they were contradicting each other. One would say this about the stadium plan. The other guy would say something else. Then that guy would say something. Then, and I don't know which way it went. You know, Chuck Knight would contradict Cornelius, and Cornelius would contradict Knight. And they said, on paper, that stadium plan looks pretty decent, but we don't know what it is. And so they voted for the Cardinals to move. And I find this out. And so I said, I got a story here. And this was on Wednesday of the league meeting week. And I was writing at the time for the Riverfront Times. I was writing sports for the Riverfront Times. I said, this will, and so I'm thinking, but it's Wednesday. I'm not going to be able to write this because Riverfront Times doesn't go to press until the following Monday and then hits the streets on either Tuesday and gets delivered around town on Tuesday or Wednesday. So I'm not going to be able to have this story because the guy in the Post-Dispatch was there. Now remember, no internet at the time, no way to monitor. So I called the editor at the Riverfront Times, told him about this story, and I said, hey, check the newspapers the next couple of days and see what's written and tell me if anything about this is written. Thursday, I check in with them. Nothing today. They just wrote about the team moving. Friday, nothing today. Nothing was written. So I said, well, here's what we'll do. I'm coming home, but I'll be home for the weekend. We'll see if there's anything, because I figured there would be kind of a wrap-up analysis on Sunday in the Sunday paper. And so sure enough, in the Sunday paper, there was a big story of what now, St. Louis? What do we do now? We've lost the football team. And they went through a whole bunch of stuff. And at the end of the story, on the jump, whatever page it jumped to in the Post-Dispatch, almost two or three paragraphs from the end, it said, and one thing St. Louis has to do is improve its presentations to the league office or something like that. Some very vanilla reference to this cursing match that had been witnessed by the Post-Dispatch reporter. I don't blame him. I'm sure that someone above him said, we're not writing that. We're not upsetting the powers and the power brokers in St. Louis. Well, you know, the Riverfront Times didn't care. So when that was there on Sunday, I called the editor at home and I said, nothing in the paper today. I'll be writing this tomorrow. And so there it was, David. A week after it happened, I was able to break the story in the Riverfront Times of what actually happened behind closed doors in the NFL meeting. It was unbelievable. It was just unbelievable that I was able to do that. So that was the one. The one that I sat on involved the Rams and Jeff Fisher. And many people will recall that after Jeff Fisher was hired as the head coach of the Rams in 2012, it came out, and Jim Thomas had the story, it came out that in the interview that Stan Kroenke did with him, he talked at length with Fisher about what's involved of relocating a team, because he had been the coach of the Houston Oilers when they relocated to Tennessee. Asked him all about that. How hard is that? What's involved? All these things. It was then reported by Jim that Fisher wanted a guarantee that the team wouldn't move. That was the story that he was told. Well, I subsequently found out from someone secondhand, but from someone who had a direct link to someone very high up in the Rams organization who told him the reverse was actually true. Fisher wanted the team to relocate.
In L.A.
He's an L.A. guy. His parents still live there. Went to USC. He wanted the team to relocate. He wasn't against it. But I was also told by the person who told me, you can't talk about this. You can't, because it'll trace to me. Now, who knows? Now, maybe the person had told somebody else that could have told the media, but he wasn't going to chance ruining his relationship because this person knew that the person he told it to that I knew. Well, and so he would have figured that that's where I got it from. And so I sat on that story until the Rams left.
Here's my last Rams question. And at this point in time, I'm not doing anything in the media. So this is just an outsider on the inside looking in. You got a guy like Kroenke who's got a room full of lawyers making $200,000 a year plus. I think before he put his wallet into the Rams coming to St. Louis, they had already played out everything that could happen, needed to happen. And when those lawyers got done with that little project, they were like, okay, yes, you're going to wait your time. You're going to wait for you to be the majority owner. And we've already played this out legally. You will have the ability to take this team to LA. What do you think of that?
It's very possible. And obviously you still have to jump through all the hoops and do what you have to do. But yeah, I think that was probably in his mind all along, because here's one interesting aspect of it that is either not known or forgotten, that it was Kroenke who sabotaged, in a way, St. Louis getting an expansion team in 93.
That's the Jacksonville team?
The one that went to Jacksonville. It was awarded in 93 for the 95 season. And at a meeting in Chicago in October, where they were supposed to award two franchises, they only awarded one to Carolina and left the other one open and said there's going to be a meeting in another month. And the league had an issue with the St. Louis ownership group. They didn't think it was up to snuff enough to come in as an expansion team. So, and Jerry Clinton, of course, from Gray Eagle, may he rest in peace, was involved in the ownership group. He didn't have the money. It was going to be, you know, mostly others. And they didn't think the ownership group was strong enough. So I'll never forget, there was a press conference at Gray Eagle, and shortly after that meeting, where they introduced Kroenke. He was going to be the knight in shining armor, or the riding in on the white horse to save St. Louis and be the owner of the team. And everyone was pretty confident about it. The problem is that he didn't want Clinton involved at all. The other problem was that, and Clinton stepped away. Clinton agreed to step away as an owner. However, he also had negotiated with the whole process a personal two-year option, a two-year hold, or he owned the lease on the dome for any football team that would play there. He owned the lease. And so, to make it clean, they had to take care of Jerry Clinton. And Kroenke and his other, whoever else might have been involved, refused to work with Jerry Clinton. Now, I know he got criticized a little bit for not totally stepping out of it, but come on. He had worked his butt off to get the dome built and all those things. Why should he step back? Just do the right thing and honor him for what he did to get that building built. Well, Kroenke wouldn't do it. So they went to Chicago in the November meeting, where they ended up awarding Jacksonville the team, and their plan for the St. Louis team with him as the owner would be to play in Busch Stadium for two full seasons, and then Clinton's lease deal would expire, and then they could move into the dome. And the league said no. The guy who, and here's the really ironic part of it, the guy who was heading up the liaison with the league office, with all the expansion teams in that process, or expansions, possible expansion cities, which also included Memphis, also included Baltimore, and I think that was about it. There was a guy named Eric Grubman who did it in the last round. The guy who was Eric Grubman's job then was Roger Goodell. And he had gotten to know Jerry Clinton. And from what I'm told, he was one of the ones that recommended to the league, this is not a right thing to do to Jerry Clinton. And that's why they awarded the team to Jacksonville. So Kroenke, so he doesn't get the Rams. I mean, he doesn't get the expansion team. That's the fall of 93, right? But he knew all the terms, obviously. He knew everything was going on. He knew what the lease was cheap. It was like $250,000 a year for 30 years. I mean, that's insane how little that is. And so what happens? When all of a sudden now the Rams are looking to leave, he piggybacks that deal, gives Georgia money, for 30% of the team, negotiates the right of first refusal. The lead, and he says to John Shaw, hey, don't pay any more than $250,000 because that's what the lease is. So he knew he had a sweetheart lease that would be easy to get out of, or at least even break if he wanted to. But he also knew of the first-tier clause that Shaw negotiated, which mandated that the Dome be up to the top eight in the NFL at 10-year and 10-year periods. First one, they let go, and they paid about $30 million for some upgrades. But the Rams let the Dome people know in the CVC, that's not going to happen the next time around. And that's pretty – so Kroenke takes – so I don't know if it was before Kroenke became the owner, but I'm sure in the back of his mind, obviously Georgia had a pass for it to happen. But, you know, when she passed in 2008, I'm fairly sure it was, she was in her early 80s. So you knew she wasn't going to live forever. But obviously you never know. But still, that had to happen for the team to be put up for sale. And then when she did, and her son and daughter didn't want to own it, and then Kroenke went through he didn't even make an offer. That's what the type of businessman he is. When they put it up for sale, he didn't even make an offer. He let others make the offer. And that was what Shad Khan did, made the offer to buy the 30% or so, whatever it was, from the kids. And Kroenke then played Khan like a drum, made it seem like he would come in with him as a partner, brought him to Denver for Nuggets games and stuff like that. And then on the final day of the 60 days that he had to decide whether to negotiate his right of first refusal, he exercised it, and Khan was out. So that was 2010. That was truly, and there might have been some stuff before that, but that was truly when the wheels really began to go in motion to affect the move, because he knew that at that point in 2010, there was only another 4 years until it could go year to year if the renovations weren't done. And they rigged the renovation, $700 million, and refused to negotiate to contribute to it, refused to negotiate the years on the lease, and everyone blames the city for not doing, oh, you could have kept the team, pay the $700 million. Well, who's going to pay $700 million for another 10 years on the lease? That's all there was left on. It was 10 years. And so if no one had moved to L.A. in those ensuing 10 years, Kroenke could have done it then. Could have just bided his time and waited a little longer. So that would have been financial suicide for the city to do that. So they knew they couldn't lose the arbitration. And once that happened, it was gone. It was very dirty. We all know it was very dirty what happened. And so be it. That's what they – it's just unfortunate that St. Louis had to be thrown under the bus and became collateral damage and got the perception of not being a football town and all that because of the greed – and the business practices of the Rams and the NFL.
Choosing to end on a positive note, Battlehawks, baby.
Yeah, Battlehawks.
So you're working with them.
Yeah, I'm doing some stuff for 590, a daily show, an hour show, and 2 hours on Friday, and we do some pregame stuff and all that, and it's kind of fun. It's a short season. It's hard to believe we're sitting here. Whenever this drops, I'm not sure, but we're sitting here after four games, and so after the fifth game, the season's half over. It just goes so fast, but it's fun. Fans are having fun, and there's no question a lot of their emotion and all that and coming out has been all this pent-up bitterness from what happened with the Rams, but team's winning, fans are enjoying it, they're having fun at the games, and it's not that expensive, and there's not that many games to commit to. So it's kind of fun, kind of good for – it's good for the city.
And it looks like at least another year for sure, the ratings are – you just have to win your time slot is the way that
right.
I look at it.
No, exactly right. That's a good point. That's a good point. And there's – there'll be – coming up in March, there'll be weekends going up against the NCAA tournament. There'll be other events – other things, first week in April will be against the Masters. And so there's always going to be something you're competing against. But they have good TV deals, and the networks are pretty happy with where it is. And in some ways, a short season is good because if you get to one, if you have too many games and all of a sudden you're at the end of the year and there's teams that are sitting there, you know, 2-13 and one and they're not real competitive games, that can affect it, not only ratings but attendance. So it's good to have a compact schedule. But I definitely know and believe that Vince McMahon, who owns everything, he owns the teams, he owns the league, he wants to show, you know, quiet the naysayers who say, quote, spring football can't work. Now, I don't know what level long term it can work. Can they make money on it? I don't know. I don't know if anybody truly knows the answer to that. But he wants to give it a real effort to find out.
Appreciate the time, man.
My pleasure, David.
And that's another one in the books. So as the world keeps spinning, this was recorded, what, maybe like 3 weeks ago? Right now, it does not look like the XFL is going to be around next year. Maybe ever again. It is a crazy time, but Howard was a great guest. I want to thank him very much for your time. I want to thank you guys for listening to this podcast, checking it out on YouTube, checking it out on wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe. Let me know again, otwitholiver@gmail.com for any episode suggestions. We keep going. We keep going. And as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.